The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, welcome to the special episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. Today is going to be one of the precursor episodes to our seance episode, which we will be recording later today, where we will probably not be anywhere near as serious as we are. But I did want to talk to some practitioners of just kind of those, for lack of a better term, occult arts. And to that effect, I had reached out to the Mile High Conjure Gala. They are doing an event November 9th and 10th. It is their third annual. And this is an incredibly special event hosted by Candelo Kimbisa. I believe I'm saying her name right. They have 2 days of workshops, a vendor fair, readers, and a gala party with drinks and dancing on Saturday night. Their presenters are some of the foremost experts in various traditions of conjure, hoodoo, and root work, and are coming from all across the country to teach their workshops. The magical knowledge they will be sharing is unique, powerful, and practical. During those 2 days, they will show you how to connect to your ancestors, to relate to herbs and the stars, to throw bones, to divine your future, to work with spirits, to walk in the graveyard, to call in blessings, and even to conquer your foes. You can find tickets at eventbrite.com/e/75035231397, which is a crazy link, but it will be up on our Facebook page that you can find with no problem, or on our website at www.totlb.com. And if you go and use the discount code LONGBOXLISTENER, you'll get $50 off the full gala ticket price. So that is super cool. So please be sure to go there. And like I said, the link will be up on all of our social media. You know how to find all that stuff. Before we get started, let me introduce our guests. The first is Professor Charles Porterfield. He is an old-fashioned, no-nonsense Old Testament reader and root worker, a well-known cardomancer. He is the author of A Deck of Spells, Hoodoo Playing Card Magic in Root Work and Conjure, and regularly lectures and teaches on cardomancy and cardomantic methods throughout the United States. He writes, teaches, and lectures on hoodoo and conjure to help preserve and pass on the roots of the work, as well as consults, prescribes, and divines work for those in need. He currently lives in Denton, Texas, with his wife, children, and grandchildren. I will have him give you his contact at the end of the interview so that if you are interested in contacting him, you'll be able to find him. I also have on the line with me Brother Moses. I'm scrolling down to his bio so I don't screw that up. Brother Moses is a conjureman, spiritual worker, teacher, and necromancer in the Old Testament prophetic tradition. Educated since early childhood in Jewish scripture and Kabbalah, he is a trained cultural anthropologist with 2 decades of study in the magic and religious practices of indigenous cultures across the globe. He lives along the Rocky Mountains north of Denver, Colorado, with his wife and 2 daughters, where he teaches, ministers, and provides spiritual readings and remedies to a diverse clientele. Charles, Moses, welcome to the show, guys. How are you today?
Doing well. Thank you for having us.
I'm with the professor, as always.
Oh, awesome. So I guess my first question would be for both of you. I'm really fascinated with this like aspect of like culture, anthropology, and of course with the spiritual aspects of it. In my whole life, I was raised a Christian, but I stepped away from that, and I've searched through a lot of different traditions to get to the point where I am in my life now. So a lot of these things are fascinating and interesting to me. But what I would love to know is, how did you guys get involved in exploring like these kind of occult themes and occult ideas in your life?
Well, shall I take it first? Here we go.
Oh, please, sir.
So that's kind of an easy question for me. I was raised in and around the tradition of hoodoo and conjure in northern and central Texas. And so this is a part of, for a lot of we Southerners, this is a part of our cultural milieu. This is a part of the backdrop of what it means to live down here. And we see that a lot of people that aren't from around here, as we say, are aware of these, you know, hoodoo and conjure from things like the blues and various media and things like that, stories, songs, all of that. So basically, yeah, I this wasn't a journey of discovery for me as much as it was a long circle back home.
And how about?
And that's a great lead off. I relate on the flip side. I grew up north and a little bit more recently than the esteemed professor. So certainly I was being exposed to the trickle down of the root conjure tradition. But I was raised in a Iranian Jewish family, and my aunt spoke to spirits and all kinds of stuff. I read Coffee. So I was raised around a lot of the kind of basic aspects of spiritualism, in the magical use of the Psalms. Like, this is just like how my grandma prescribed remedies for literally any condition a child might have, you know, from trouble at school to like, you know, bloody nose. So yeah, this, I guess I was steeped in sort of a branch of it, and then became extremely fascinated with the African diasporic traditions in my undergraduate, and dove into those as a field of personal study and fascination, and then, you know, experimentation, and then vocation, and now straight up profession.
So you are both clearly well-educated men. You have the anthropological aspect of it. How did it come to be that not just from an anthropological, from a spiritual side, this became such an important part of your belief systems? Like, is it, you know, was there one before, you know, obviously there was one before the other for Charles, in that he grew up in it. And for Moses, you kind of came into it. But was there ever a moment where you had to reconcile like the anthropology side of it with the spiritual side of it?
So one of the, you know, luckily I'm not a sociologist, because that might be a harder question to answer. Anthropologists, you know, we live it. That's what makes it anthropology. You truly live a culture. It was, and I guess what was made it natural for me was that it was not that far off the culture I grew up in, right? Like my grandparents used like, you know, more exotic plants that you had to go to a specialty store for rather than just the local grocer. But like a lot of this stuff I had, it seemed incredible. The use of eggs and chickens, especially the use of the crossroads, especially, was like, I've seen this. I know this. And indeed, like these are all connected traditions. Once you look at the back of the tapestry.
And for me, I don't think that ever happened.
So when you're looking at the kind of spiritual side of this, I personally am an atheist. And so as a consequence, I believe that there is a spiritual side to life, but not necessarily that there's like a deity in charge of it. Like, I feel like there's a energy that, you know, emanates from us and is a part of the things around us, but isn't necessarily something that won't eventually be described by science. How do you, you know, confront people? I mean, I guess confront is probably the wrong term, but how do you approach people that don't necessarily believe that there is a God or is a devil?
Conveniently enough, I teach a course on this specific topic. Professor, may I?
By all means.
Thank you, sir. Firstly, I want to say that that's not at all incompatible. The understanding of God is anthropomorphic is pretty like unhandy and actually not accurate to how we interact with that concept in any way. So I think you're probably closer, your understanding of what a godlike concept might be, perhaps a first cause, an all-encompassing intelligence, essentially a fundamental patterning to, you know, the knowledge or the information that is the universe, I should say. Then you're approaching a concept of God, you know, and I think that's something that science perhaps will come to, perhaps come to abstract, but to actually cognize maybe, you know, it's that old thing of like, can a fish inside a pond cognize the pond, right? Like it's essentially encompassing of us. We get into a weird quantum physics thing in terms of the ability to perceive it accurately rather than to perceive it in a way that's affecting the perception of it. I'm ranting a little here. The point being, though, it's not irreconcilable.
Well, for me, it's a moot point, and I'll tell you why. So, as we conceive of it, hoodoo, conjure, this is a folk magic tradition, and perhaps later on we can discuss its no pun intended roots and how it evolved and came to be here in America. But the thing you have to know right off the bat is it is not what is termed an ATR. An ATR, that stands for African Traditional Religion, okay? And ATRs do have inherent components involving deity or deities. Hoodoo and conjure does not descend directly out of African traditional religions. It descends out of African traditional sorcery. It is a sorceress practice and is the descendant child of African sorceress societies, secret African sorceress societies like, the Leopard Men and the Kanye and things like that. So what we're really talking about when we're talking about my practice is it is a form of sorcery. So because it's a form of sorcery, it doesn't have a, you know, carry along luggage component about deity. And in fact, as I often teach, the thing one would need to know about hoodoo is that it is pragmatic. It is based on a law of pragmatism. And that way it is expressed in hoodoo is, if it works, it must be true. So in other words, I never have to have any sort of intellectual deep breathing exercises about, is there a divine force in the universe? Is there a greater consciousness that guides all things, or a creator or creatrix? I have my own personal beliefs on that. I am, in fact, a Jew. But that does not mingle necessarily with my sorceress practice. My sorceress practice is simply this. I do this. Did it bring about a result? Okay. Can I reduplicate that? I can. Okay. So to me, that almost falls under a kind of pre-age of reason scientific model, which is basically pragmatism.
That's super interesting. Like, I guess as somebody that hasn't, you know, done too much of the work, but more just read books about, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to really test a whole lot of the, if I do this, does it cause this sort of thing? And that's actually really fascinating to me. Professor, you had talked about, you know, discussing the roots of where this particular brand of like conjure or sorcery comes from. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I would be glad to. Please remember to shut me up when it's gone too far.
Okay.
So because this is a story, and it is it's an ongoing story. It's a story that has a beginning, but it doesn't yet have an end, and hopefully, you know, as long as I'm around, it won't. So this story begins in Africa, and the first and most important thing we always need to say is this: hoodoo, conjure, even root work, as we think of them as Southern folk traditions, belong to African Americans. It is an essential part of African American conjure. Those of us who, for one reason or another, are not African American or are not African American presenting, I happen to be the child of a mixed race mother, owe it as guests at the table to always say that. Okay? We always have to start there, because otherwise we're going to lose our way. And then it just becomes this appropriative, you know, the world's just a buffet. The world is not a goddamn buffet. You know, thank your hosts, have good manners, wash your hands and your face and act like decent people. Now, yes, exactly. Now, beginning in Africa, we have the emergence of the African slave trade. Most of this, in terms of what we're going to be discussing, we're going to be talking about West Africa. So people because I don't like it when people say slaves taken from West Africa. These are not slaves taken from West Africa. These are normal people kidnapped and thrown into slavery and transported to the Americas, okay, are brought to America. And in America, they are brought to two places, primarily huge wide areas, the Anglo Quarter and the Latin Quarter. The Latin Quarter are those parts of the Americas and North America, what will eventually be, you know, the full United States, that are controlled by the Spanish, the French, basically the Catholic-run or Catholic-observant countries. The Anglo Quarter is that vast stretch of area that is controlled by primarily the Protestant countries. Now, two interesting things happen. In the Latin Quarter, there are certain laws that are on the records. We, you know, this is a matter of history, that descend from basically a Catholic perspective under the rulership of whatever popes we have during the time. And not to paint them as being heroes, they're not. They're still slavers. They have an important differentiation from the Anglo Quarter. They say these slaves are human beings. Oh, they're lesser human beings. Oh, they're primitives. Oh, they live in darkness. And we have an obligation, what would later be called white man's burden, to elevate them out of darkness. But they're humans. And because they're humans, you have to give them certain quote-unquote rights. Now, that's kind of a strange statement when you're talking about slaves. And they're not really rights as we would conceive of them in the modern era. But those rights include things like you have to occasionally let them have some time off. Now, that's certainly not the weekend or anything that the labor movement brought any of us. That's, oh, maybe once a month or specifically for certain saint days, right? They get time off. You should still allow them to, on occasion, speak their indigenous tongues, so long as they learn the tongue of our land, the elevated tongue, whatever that is, French, Spanish, Italian, etc., Portuguese. And there's nothing wrong with letting them keep, oh, some of their indigenous instruments, their indigenous songs, their indigenous dances. Because of this, as an example, in one place in the Latin Quarter, New Orleans, we have Congo Square. Congo Square, you can still go visit Congo Square to this day. And in Congo Square, slaves were allowed to gather. They were allowed to talk. They were allowed to drum. They were allowed to speak and sing on certain occasions. Now, what that means can happen is this. Some of those kidnapped people who have now been cast into slavery were, in fact, back home. You know, some of them are farmers. Some of them are just normal people. Some of them are tradesmen. Some of them are crafters. But a few of them are priests and priestesses of religions existing in Africa. They quickly sort out, you know, what's going on here. Oh, great, we're slaves. Hooray, everybody loves that. And what they do is they are able to keep their religion alive, although disguised, behind Catholic effigies. All right? So as an example, in Haitian Voudon, we find that the Loa are associated with Catholic saints. In Santeria, well, the practice of Santeria is even called Santeria, Santos, to saints. Okay? So what happens is they keep their religions, but they synchronize them, and they keep them out of the public eye behind a Catholic veneer. All right, so what do we end up with in the modern era? We end up with ATRs, Santeria, Camboye, Kimbanda, Voudan, Palo. All right, now, what happens in the Anglo Quarter? Uh-oh, in the Anglo Quarter, the rule is these people are animals. They are not human beings. They are animals. What is this system called? Chattel slavery. And chattel slavery is the rule of thumb in the entire Anglo quarters. Now, what does that mean? That means you have no rights. You're a freaking animal. In fact, we'll even breed you. Okay? And we have breeding farms and other horrors that only things like slavery can produce. So what happens? Language dies, music dies, therefore religion dies, etc. Except some of those people in the Anglo Quarter are captured, they're prisoners, they're kidnapped people, now slaves, out of African sorceress traditions, African sorceress societies. and they don't need they're not clergy, right? They don't need a congregation. They don't need others. They were a sorcerer in Africa. They're a sorcerer in Georgia. They're a sorcerer in Virginia, and they can still ply their trade. And then this fantastic thing happens that can only happen in America, kind of a weird success out of horror story. That ideal that we are always trying to live up to and failing in America of the great melting pot takes place. The first thing that happens is these African slaves, because we can't call them African Americans, they're not Americans, they're property, meet the indigenous Native Americans and start to have dialogues with them. This is necessary because not everything that grew and lived in Africa is here, and you might have, as part of your sorcerer's practice, known to use a root or a plant or a flower that existed in Africa, doesn't exist in Virginia and the Carolinas. So you start finding out stuff from Native Americans, first tribe members. So what happens immediately because of this pragmaticism, because it's broken into two camps. Pragmaticism is, if it works, it is true, and if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me. What immediately happens is Native American folk magic traditions and sorcerous traditions get blended in with the African sorcerous traditions. All right, now fast forward a while. Fast forward past emancipation to the Great Northern Migration. In the Great Northern Migration, actually, let me stop for a moment. There is one other immediate integration, which is there is the integration of English, Scottish, and Irish folk magic traditions. And where do they come from? They come out of the master's house, quote unquote, the big house. And those people that own you, they have a folk magic tradition. And this gets blended into hoodoo. And the primary reason it gets blended into hoodoo is because Master and Missy are scared of that shit. Okay? So let me give you one example. In hoodoo, we have a tradition that talks about black spirit dogs, large black spirit dogs, ghost dogs, church grims, graveyard dogs, all right? And you might have, if you're a fan of the blues, you've probably heard Robert Johnson's Hellhound on My Trail,
right?
Okay? And a lot of them call them hellhounds. All right. This only comes from England.
Right.
None of that. There are no black spirit dogs in Africa.
It's the mythology that Hound of the Baskervilles plays on.
Exactly. Hound of the Baskervilles, etc. Now, if Master, who literally can fuck my life up just because he's in a bad mood, is scared of that shit, and if I can go find one of these black spirit dogs, guess what? Now Master's busy dealing with a black spirit dog. He ain't coming down here and fucking with us. Pardon my language. All right? So that gets blended in. So now we've got African sorcery, Native American folk magic, English, Scottish, and Irish folk magic. After the emancipation and the Great Northern Migration, at this point in time, cities are still, in America, are vastly segregated.
Right.
I mean, there's vast segregation. We think, as modern people, of segregation as being something that happens only between, quote, blacks and whites. That's not true. In the old miserable days, that happened because of other groups. So, as an example, Jews living in a lot of northern cities lived in segregated ghettos. It's a Jewish word, right? It comes originally out of Venice, right? That was the first ghetto. The first ghetto was for Jews. So we're living in ghettos in Baltimore, Chicago, etc. Jewish pharmacists, as an example, are not allowed to fill scripts or compound for white clients. All right? That's the law. But they can for black clients. So, man, what you often find in these cities is that the black neighborhood and the Jewish neighborhood, the black ghetto and the Jewish ghetto, are side by side. So they become friends, and they start passing information back and forth. What immediately happens? Now there's a layer of Jewish folk magic, Judaic and Hebraic folk magic that's immediately added in to hoodoo. That's part of the reason that Brother Moses and I can hang so well.
Right.
Because coming into hoodoo, we're finding some of our own folk magic, just like he said. Now what happens? Great westward migration happens, building the railroad. Along the way, now, liberated, emancipated, African Americans still living in oppression, but now we can actually call them African Americans, meet who? What was termed in the day as the Celestials. In other words, they meet Chinese people. What immediately happens? boom, you mix Chinese folk magic in. Then later, on the West Coast, you will find sub-Asiatic and Indian folk magic, Indian subcontinent folk magic mixed in. And then the last would happen during the Southern migration into Mexico, Central America, etc., where you start seeing Corindesmo and Mestizo folk magic being mixed in with hoodoo. So what do we have? We have this quintessentially American thing, like jazz or chop suey, right? It only exists here. It's gumbo, all right? The roux comes from France. The okra comes from Africa, etc. But it only happens here. And hoodoo is quintessentially American. In fact, there's an interesting historic note to talk about that. During the Civil War, there were two large plantations in the South who saw the war coming, said, screw that, and picked up everything, kit and caboodle, slaves, property, loaded them onto ships, and they moved to Australia. They became successful plantations in Australia. And up until about the 1930s, there was still a hoodoo tradition in Australia. But it was dying off by the 1930s. There were almost no practitioners. By the 1960s, there was no one left. The tradition doesn't live there anymore. Why? Because it couldn't continue to advance, take in. It didn't have – because now it's an Australian event.
Right.
And in Australia, there wasn't that level of cultural sharing. So that's the history of hoodoo and conjure in America. It is this seven-layer bean dip of folk magic from a bunch of different cultures, and yet there has never been a guiding council. There is no hoodoo pope. There has never been an ecclesiastical board to sit down and carefully piece it together. It has organically, through its pragmatism, pieced itself together and worked. We kept this, we got rid of that. We kept this, we get rid of that. We like that because it calls and sounds to this. They all interrelate and agree. And so rather than just having a strange jumble, what you have is a fully functional quilt of magical and sorcerous work.
Never expected to hear it described as seven-layer bean dip. I'm going to be really honest. So Brother Moses, talking, you know, obviously, a lot of this comes from the South, moves north, then goes back down into the South. As a practitioner that lives in the Rocky Mountains and, like, you know, in this part of the country, we're probably actually very close to each other. I'm in Greeley right now. So, what is it like experiencing, like, kind of these concepts and these ideas from a northern perspective? Does it feel different? Do you find that you know, work in different ways than people that come from the South?
In some ways. So I'll say this. I grew up in Essex County, New Jersey, which for weird statistical purposes is one of the most diverse counties in North America. So I have a weird, and by happenstance, exposure to the core folk magics of a lot of these cultures at the same time, and especially, you know, through the, you know, growing up in the African American community, basically, you know, being a rapper for many years, it goes around. And honestly, the passing of conjure between cultures through the music world, jazz at one point, eventually hip hop, and lucky things of that sort, is not uncommon. I'd say that anyone who believes in luck, which is people who tend to live on more sort of luck-based living, where there's a good day and a bad day rather than just regularity, is going to be prone to taking a pragmatic approach to folk magic straight up. And so I was exposed to a lot of it growing up. The lady who raised my little brother was sort of an espiritista in sort of a spiritism, as we call it. And so, I don't know, I just kind of saw a lot of the pieces. Moving now out here to Colorado, I'm a bit of a curiosity out here. There's like a handful of other practitioners versus it just being kind of what everyone's granny did. So it's certainly different for me. I don't mind it. I have an opportunity to really educate a lot of people on it it is often difficult to connect things to the roots and certainly to acquire the actual roots, pun intended, per the professor, necessary for some of this work. But also, like, my close colleagues live in Texas, South Carolina, and these are the guys I, you know, I work bigger jobs with and talk to on a kind of daily basis. So it keeps me anchored. It keeps me rooted, pun again intended. It's getting a little ridiculous now. And lets me stay plugged in for supplies as well. I think in isolation out here, it would be pretty stark, to be frank.
It's interesting. So there's kind of two sides to what I'm about to say. So growing up in a Hispanic family, there are a lot of like folk traditions that when you talk about like the eggs and the chickens and things like that, you know, my grandma would pull sickness out of people using an egg and that sort of thing. You know, mm-hmm. those folk traditions mm-hmm. exist like in the Hispanic culture. And as a consequence, so like as I said, we're doing our seance episode tonight, which will probably be a lot more tongue in cheek than anything else. And probably us just being kind of dorks, but my daughter is a sole practitioner of witchcraft. And so she was like, well, you know, if we're going to do this, even if it's, you know, kind of jokey, we're definitely going to like, you know, protect the house. And so she went to like the local herb store and trying to find the different things that are in her tradition were kind of difficult. Like you said, you know, not every place sells frankincense, for example, like,
sure.
And then explaining sure. the language barrier and things like that. It's just really interesting, you know, you talking about being in this part of the country and having a hard time finding things that you need for your practice. Like I got to literally experience that today. It's fascinating to me.
And you know, what marks what I find as I, you know, been doing this a couple years at this level, is that what really marks a consummate professional is the ability to pull it together wherever you are on the ground. You know, I'll go up in someone's kitchen and pull out what I need if I got it. I'll do it with a piece of paper and a pen, you know, a white candle on a glass of water. But working with the tools and finding the tools, that's the other side is, as you were saying, there's sort of a regionalism to it. So here I work with a lot more Latin American, specifically Mexican style workings, because that's what's available, right? There's a Mexican community in Denver. I can go to the Botanicas. I can pick up, you know, herbs that are well prescribed in that tradition and have sort of some absorption into hoodoo and conjure. And likewise, you can find a lot of the Cuban plants and ingredients if you know where you're going. And again, much of that has had a lot of crossover, especially where I saw it growing up in New Jersey. A lot of the ATRs, as the professor was describing, kind of it all bled together up there, as everything does in New Jersey. It's just a kind of a big mess. But so I don't know. I'm flexible. You know, when I'm up here, I work one way. If I'm on a house call in California, I'm working that maybe another way. And that's, to me, that's part of one of the hallmarks of conjure specifically as a tradition. It's not like ritual magic where you have this like, you're inscribing this circle on the ground and you need this table full of austere implements. And like, no, man, you just go out there and you talk to the spirits and make it happen. And you do it in a repeatable way, as the professor said, and then you're doing the work.
Right. It's,
I also think for this, it's important to have a good concept of what quote the West means. Because we think of things as they are settled now, right? I mean, Golden Spike, and oh, we've reached the ocean, and now we can know where the West is. The West was a movable concept. All right. Mm. I mean, I do a lot of work and travel often to Omaha, Nebraska, and Omaha, Nebraska used to be considered the West. Okay, and what you find is as you go west, as you are quote going west, you find towns that are founded or that their major industry is about being different and lawlessness mm-hmm. or breaking rules. I mean, no one nowadays thinks of Omaha, Nebraska as being this wild-ass town. But there are old ballads, old Western ballads that say, son, as you go west, do not stop in Omaha because it's the devil's town, okay? Because it was a center of prostitution and gambling and all this stuff. And that story keeps being repeated as you go west. And you have to think again about the African American men and families as they're going along who are helping build railroads and towns, etc., and they're leaving things behind. So whenever you have a, quote, Western town that has some sort of oddness to it, Omaha's one because it was considered a lawless place. Denver was another because basically people got to Denver, looked at the rest of the mountains, and said, screw it. Yeah. No, it's enough. I'm staying here. Not going any further. And everybody else said, no, we're going to come on. We got wagons. No, I'm going to stay here. San Francisco is like weirdness magnet central. Okay. And what you find in all of those places are remnants of conjure, remnants of hoodoo in Omaha, in Denver. Oakland, California, right there next to San Francisco, it was one of the havens of hoodoo and conjure up until almost the 1970s. All right? And so that's always there. So we kind of have to double think when we start saying things like the West, because the West is an experience that moves.
So as we're wrapping up our conversation, you know, we're about to go into seance mode here in just a second. What is the one piece of advice each of you would give us for what we're going to do tonight?
I'll let Brother Moses take that one first.
Well, I'll give the one that my well-qualified colleagues have given me. In this situation, be aware that you're allowing spirits to enter your consciousness. So if you notice anything, smell something, hear something, feel something, sense something, think something, emote in some way, make it known to the group, both because that's the seance happening, and because if it's a spirit that ought to be driven away, that'll make it known to the group, and it can be appropriately driven away.
Good advice. Very good advice. Mine's a little vaguer. Have you ever been around annoying tourists?
Yeah, we actually were just talking about annoying tourists.
Good. I call that a token of spirit that you were just talking about it, okay? Because now I'm going to talk to you about it. Everybody hates an annoying tourist, okay? So consider this. There is the kingdom of the living, and there is the kingdom of the dead. And those two may overlay each other, but hey, China's on the globe with America, and you can fly to China and be a really annoying damn tourist, okay? So don't go into the kingdom of the dead, or in this case, make a telephone call to the kingdom of the dead, and be an annoying tourist, because you're probably going to get the same experience that you would give people if they were annoying tourists around you. In other words, have a respect, have a somewhat serious attitude when visiting somebody else's quote-unquote kingdom, the same way you would want somebody coming to your town to treat your town with some level of decency and respect and good manners if they were a tourist.
All right. That's fair advice, and probably advice that we need to hear tonight, and I'll be sure to relay that to the other people in the group tonight. Before I let you go, Professor, brother, I think it's fun to say it like that. Can you let us know how people can find you guys personally?
I can be found at professorporterfield.com. It's easy, not hard. Just professorporterfield.com. You can find me, my books, my lecture dates, etc. And also, if you happen to be in Colorado, you can find me at the Mile High Conjure Gala, November 9th and 10th.
And Brother Moses?
And you can find me at hoodoomoses.com or hoodoomoses on Instagram is the quick and dirty way to get at me. And I will also be at the Conjure Gala this year, and we would love to connect with you there.
Well, thank you guys so much for your time. And, of course, I'd love to bring up the Conjure Gala one last time. You can go to conjuregala.com to find out more information about it. I wish we had a little bit more time to talk about it tonight, but I have to keep the recording moving on. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Like, I feel like you're the kind of guys that I would love to sit in a room and talk with for, like, 6 hours. So I may end up trying to go to said Conjure Gala. But you can go to their website and use Longbox Listener as a coupon code to get $50 off of the ticket price for the full gala. it sounds like you guys are going to do something really amazing and something really fascinating for the third annual event. There's all sorts of things planned, workshops and classes. And if they're anywhere near as engaging as you two have been, that should be, at the very least, a very fun time, especially if you're interested in any of this kind of, for, like I said, for lack of a better term, kind of occult subject matter. This has been a pleasure of a conversation for me. I'm, as I said, I'm completely fascinated with this sort of thing, and I've been reading about it most of my life. And honestly, this is the first time I'm going to sit down and even do something like this. So it, we will take your advice to heart. And yeah, I think we're going to have a really good time tonight.
Well, I hope you do. And thank you for having us.
Sorry, you guys both said it at once. Well,
I said good luck and thank you for having us.
Oh, thank you very much for being on. And Brother Moses?
Yeah, Godspeed and thanks for having us. Likewise.
Of course.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Barren Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barren Space production.